Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. This afternoon's topic is a courthouse staff's oral argument Teleforum on the case argued this morning, Uzabunum versus Prashevsky. My name is Michael Wallen, and I'm the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Sarah Harris, who's a partner in the Supreme Court and Appellate Practice at Williams & Connolly. We also have Justin Sadowski, who's an attorney for Council on American Islamic Relations. And our moderator today is Casey Maddox, who's a senior fellow of free speech and toleration at the Charles Koch Institute, as well as a vice president for legal and judicial strategy at Americans for Prosperity. After our speakers and panel have their opening remarks and discussion, we will then open up the floor for a live audience Q&A. Thank you all for sharing with us today. And Casey, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you, Micah. My name is Casey Maddox, and I will give you just a bit of a rundown of the background on this case, and then we will kick off a discussion of why this case is important, why you should care, essentially how we think oral argument went and what the themes are coming out of the argument. So back in 2016, Georgia Gwinnett College officials stopped a young man named Chike Uzabunum from speaking on his campus about his faith. He had gone out close to the library and decided he wanted to discuss his faith. And they stopped him and told him that he couldn't do that because the school had a speech zone policy that limited expression of that kind to about 1% of the campus. And even then, only about 10% of the week. So it was a very limited space, basically one patio on the campus that could be used for the purposes of free expression. So Chike followed their orders. He reserved a time to go to the speech zone and speak about his faith. But when he did that, just within a few minutes, two other officers approached him, demanded to see his card, his permission to be able to speak in the speech zone. And then they told him that, in fact, he had actually engaged in disorderly conduct because he had disturbed the peace and tranquility of other people in that speech zone because of the content of his speech. Again, everyone agrees that it was simply religious speech. It wasn't anything more than that or in a different tone. So as a result, he was unable to speak about his faith anywhere on campus. And without that permit, he was banned from speaking then in any of the campus speech zones. So ADF challenged the policy. As a matter of fact, at the time, this is before I was in my current roles, I was the director of the Alliance Defending Freedom Center for Academic Freedom. So I was involved in filing that lawsuit. We challenged the case, challenged those policies in federal court. The first response from the Georgia Attorney General's office, representing Georgia Gwinnett College, was to argue in part that no constitutional violation had occurred. And as a matter of fact, his speech was not even protected because they argued that religious speech on a college campus was tantamount to fighting words. They later withdrew that motion to dismiss, decided to change their policy several months later. And ultimately, having changed their policy and more broadly permitting free speech on the campus, then filed a motion to dismiss, arguing that the case was now moot, that the policies had been resolved and there was nothing else for the court to do. That was then appealed. So the district court granted that motion to dismiss. It went to the 11th Circuit, which in an unpublished opinion upheld the decision dismissing the case on mootness grounds. And the argument was essentially that if you only have nominal damages, so when we filed the case, when Chike had filed the case, the claim was filed both for injunctive relief to stop the policy from happening going forward, but also for a $1 nominal damages claim for the violation of his constitutional rights. The 11th Circuit agreed with the district court that the presence of that nominal damages claim, now that the policies had been changed, was insufficient to prevent the case from being moot, and that's the question that the Supreme Court took up. This is occurring on the backdrop of recent cases where the court has been presented with similar questions, which I'm sure the panelists will get into. Georgia argues that fundamentally there is no Article III controversy in this case. That if there are only nominal damages at issue, that is insufficient to present an Article III question for a court, and so it therefore lacks jurisdiction. I'll ask then we can begin with Sarah, because I would like for both of you to have the opportunity to explain what your interest in the case is, and to talk about the briefs that you filed, and then we can get into some of the questions about the argument itself.
Great. Well, thank you so much for having me, and thanks to all the listeners. I think this is a truly important case, even though when you hear that the question presented is whether a claim for nominal damages can keep a case alive, you think it's going to sort of be a dry civil procedure and civil procedure / Article III type case. But the reason I think my clients and I are interested in this case, and we filed an amicus brief on behalf of the ACLU, Americans for Prosperity Foundation, Americans United for Separation of Church and State, and the Institute for Justice. So groups that do not often, I think, come together and align on issues. But what quickly became apparent was that everyone sort of had a story of litigating a case in which you have a civil rights plaintiff, someone whose constitutional rights were violated. The government then gets sued. You know, you sued for an injunction going forward, but you've also made a claim for nominal damages, at least because someone was hurt already. The government changes its policy and says, well, what else is there to see here? Can't we get rid of this case? And so everyone had a story about how they sort of wanted to say, no, like my client has still been hurt. There is a harm in the past. It's a constitutional right. It might not be easy to quantify in monetary terms, but that $1 of nominal damages is something that reflects, you know, much more immeasurable harms, the loss of your constitutional rights. And you should be able to vindicate that by continuing to litigate your case so that courts will say, yes, you suffered this wrong and you get a dollar as a poor, but still very real measure of damage for it. So that's our interest in the case. And our brief, I should say, argued not only that nominal damages keep cases alive, but also sort of walked through how many cases this really does come up in, that governments do often, you know, for good or bad reasons, choose to change their policies when they're sued. And looking at all the situations in which plaintiffs have been allowed to proceed with these cases and why sort of the sky won't fall if that rule remains the rule.
Great. Thank you, Sarah. And I should say thank you for representing us at Americans for Prosperity Foundation. We were very, very pleased to be on that brief. So appreciate your great work there. Justin, would you like to kind of offer the position from CARE and why this is such a concern, I think, kind of really for a broader array of civil rights lawyers?
Yeah. So CARE obviously litigates a lot in the areas of both, you know, religious freedom as well as, you know, equal protection areas. And I came to CARE thinking that that's what I'd be mostly doing is First Amendment, 14th Amendment, you know, RFRA, RLUIPA, all the fun religion and equal protection statutes. And it turns out that being a litigator for a civil rights firm, you know, that represents Muslims, and I'm sure it's not different for civil rights firms elsewhere, is you're mostly a standing lawyer. Court, you know, you're constantly dealing with the issue that Sarah was referencing, which is, you know, the government says, oh, we're no longer going to do this. Why are we even discussing this? And we've had cases, you know, where it's not the government's no longer going to do this generally. They're just not going to do it to our particular plaintiffs. I mean, Texas, in one of our cases, literally amended the law not to get rid of the law the district court found unconstitutional, but just to say that the class of plaintiffs that brought the case were exempt from the law. And again, that's not unusual. We're constantly fighting those battles. But the brief we wrote along with John Friend, who's a fantastic lawyer who helped us out pro bono on the case was focused on, you know, other reasons why, you know, courts won't otherwise be able to hear a case, primarily because of mootness, if you can't bring a damages action. And in those cases, damages actions would only be available under a concept of nominal damages. We represent a lot of prisoners in incarceries, in RLUIPA cases. Every year we have a series of cases throughout the country where incarcerees are not being fed a Ramadan diet because of the way prisons and jails operate and the availability of food outside of mealtimes. If they're not being fed a Ramadan diet, they're literally not being fed for 30 days. We have that case, and yet, you know, courts have often held that those cases become moot 30 days later. And 30 days is not enough time to bring a case. So if we don't have a damages case, we don't have a case. But if there's no physical injury under the Prison Litigation Reform Act, then we wouldn't have a compensatory damages case. So, you know, you don't have the, if you can't bring the injunctive relief case, you can't bring a damages case without physical injury. Absent physical injury, you know, these cases are just not justiciable. And, you know, basically that means those rights that the Constitution affords, both statutory and constitutional rights that, I guess, that Congress and the Constitution affords, you know, prisoners of religious faith in, who are incarcerated in our prisons and jails, they just don't exist. And so that's what our brief focused on. And our brief mentions a case called United States versus Sanchez Gomez and discusses that case. That's in part because it's an issue we deal with. It's in part because our co-counsel is a learned class action lawyer, which is the government's answer to some of these cases where there's just a fleeting thing is maybe if you bring it as a class action. But as our brief talks about, bringing a case as a class action really makes those cases a lot more difficult, if not impossible, to be brought in, isn't a solution. And so really, in a lot of these cases, if we don't have the nominal damages claim, we don't have a claim at all.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I think it's important to clarify here, and obviously, you know, if either of you have a check on this, feel free to say so. But this is not sort of novel. The question about whether or not nominal damages should be sufficient to avoid mootness is not a brand new thing. Essentially, almost I think at least every circuit does this right now. That this is the general rule, is that nominal damages are sufficient, except for in the 11th Circuit now. And so that's the context in which the court granted cert. There are some, you know, questions about or kind of more around the edges on the doctrine. But the current default, if you are a litigator, is that nominal damages are going to be sufficient. That may potentially be at least some form of a signal to way the court may rule, but I think not necessarily. So let me go ahead and maybe get to that question that everyone is really probably joining this call to hear, and give you a chance to give an answer to this question, and then your thoughts as to why, both from what you heard today and otherwise. Who do you expect to win? Sarah?
Sure. So with the caveat that the telephone arguments can be harder to call, I do think that Shiki will prevail. And here's the reason, sort of twofold. One is listening to arguments, some clues that the justices offer. So while they peppered Christian Wagner, who did a fantastic job for Shiki, and Hashim Mupan, who did a wonderful job for the United States, with a lot of questions, a lot of the justices seem to tip their hand a bit more in Andrew Pinson's argument for Georgia. He's also a fantastic advocate. But some of the clues that I think can sort of show where the justices were going on this were, for instance, when Justice Kavanaugh, who often tips his hand a little more in these arguments than others, sort of said, well, I think you have a lot of things going against you, precedent, common law, common sense, and the fact, as you mentioned, Casey, that a lot of these other courts of appeals have already sort of been applying the rule that nominal damages keep the case live and nothing bad has happened. Or Justice Gorsuch sort of saying to Andrew that he's worried that Georgia's rule in which you have to have some sort of risk that the harm will recur as a basis for nominal damages might really disadvantage people who the very people who kind of would expect nominal damages to help, namely people who don't want to claim more money than they actually want and are happy to settle for a dollar, or people who are unwilling to plead compensatory damages and go through the process of, for instance, substantiating their emotional harm. So lots of questions like that, I think, in Georgia's portion in the argument suggest that I would guess they have at least 7 to 8 votes for Chiquet's position. The one, I think, person I'm not sure where he stands is the Chief Justice, who sounded to me much more sympathetic to Georgia's position. And the second clue, I think, right, is simply the votes in New York State rifle and pistol from last term, in which Justices Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch basically said that they think that when you have a constitutional violation and that there was some sort of past harm, that is sufficient to save the case from mootness. And I think that would sort of equally apply here.
All right. And Justin?
Yeah, I see the case similarly. I came into this case expecting Uzug Bunham to prevail, and I didn't hear anything differently. I think Sarah's recitation of Kavanaugh, I think, really nails it down. You know, she said, you know, as he said, or as they both said, precedent, common law, and common sense. And I think by that they mean, in order for the government to prevail in this case, they would have to overcome certain Supreme Court precedents, which is always possible. Supreme Court can revisit their precedents. But they were arguing against sort of a historic common law where, you know, going back into, you know, back into constitutional times even, you know, and we are all originalists now, you know, these claims were capable of going forward. And so they were going to have a hard time selling, you know, the originalists on the court that the government should prevail and these cases should no longer be brought under, you know, the lack of a case or controversy. And then on top of that, common sense, which, you know, as Casey was saying to me earlier, to really understand the backdrop of this case, you'd need to take a whole day in standing Article III law. But this court is constantly struggling with, you know, when to allow cases to go forward and when not to allow cases to go forward, because the case really is, you know, not worth the expense on it. There's not enough at stake to really vindicate those rights. And there are issues with, and that goes to sovereign immunity and issues of qualified immunity, issues of when attorney's fees can be provided, and some of which were discussed in the backdrop of this case. But based on the questioning I heard, it confirmed is that this would have been a step too far in terms of shutting the courtroom door. And you really needed, I really would have needed to hear either, you know, the court either to hear them strongly willing to revisit past precedent or past ideas, or to sound a little bit more like a court ready to sort of make a revolutionary shift in the way we think of things. I didn't hear that. And so I agree with Sarah that I'd be very surprised. I would suspect 9-0. I think, you know, I don't know if the chief, if he had his way, but I doubt the chief is going to push this hard to have a dissent. It might be 8-1 or 7-2, but I expect a 9-0. Affirmance.
So it seems to me that a lot of people listening to this argument.
Sorry, not affirmance, reversal.
Right. But, you know, I think a lot of people listening to the argument, you know, and I think Sarah made the point earlier at the beginning about how challenging it is really to read tea leaves in on these telephonic arguments, because every justice is asking questions of every advocate. One way that you could read the tea leaves before was that if the justice had no questions for anybody else and really peppered one advocate, then, you know, you could sort of get a good sense. When the justices start asking questions, they're almost never, even if they agree with you, they're rarely asking questions that are, you know, you're right, aren't you? Tell me more about why you're right. You know, they're asking sort of challenging questions. And it seemed to be that the challenges here were around the sort of outer limits of, you know, what this could mean. How do we avoid, you know, if we side for Chiquet, how do we avoid doing so in a way that creates other problems? Or, you know, is a clear rule that just says nominal damages are sufficient? Does that work, or are there, you know, concerns we should have? And I'm curious about your thoughts on, you know, where those gray areas may have been, particularly in the arguments for Chiquet. I know that there are differences sometimes in the way people think about cases where there has been an actual application of the policy versus one in which the policy exists. It sort of, you know, threatens you in the sense that the government has a policy that says you are not permitted to do this thing or we will punish you, but has not actually been enforced against you. And I think that I could imagine that being a distinction. And I, you know, I think from Kavanaugh's question, I think he would probably, at least there was an implication that he would be more comfortable with less attorney's fees in cases where nominal damages were at issue or nominal damages alone. But Sarah, let's go back to you. What do you think are some of those kind of gray areas in Shikei's position that may kind of make their way into an opinion, sort of caveating a victory?
Sure. So I think there's kind of three areas that I think you can find from the way the argument progressed. The first you've already alluded to, which is, does it matter whether the law has already been enforced or not? And Justice Thomas asked, I think, at least three questions during the argument of both sides about this issue. And what he's really getting at, I think, is if the law has already been enforced against someone, it's easier to find that there is an injury that has, in fact, happened, a past injury to remedy. Whereas I think some of the court seems a little less comfortable with the idea that there might be some sort of chill on speech or some other right where you're deterred from exercising the right. How do you really prove that? Are there sufficient breaks on showing that, you know, you wanted to do something and you couldn't? Can you still get into court that way? And so that's the sort of the first area. I think you could see Justice Thomas's a narrow position perhaps revealing to say, look, it's very clear that Shikei had the school policy enforced against him, so that's not an issue in this case. The court could conceivably leave open, are there enough guardrails with respect to policies that haven't been enforced yet? And then secondly, and sort of relatedly, Justices Breyer, Sotomayor, and Alito had a series of questions about Joseph Bradford, who's the other plaintiff in the case, who did make this sort of chilling claim, who said, look, I didn't actually try to go in the speech zone, but I did see what happened to Shikei. I mean, he was threatened with discipline and expulsion. And so I was intending to engage in similar speech. I was deterred from doing so. And so a series of questions about whether people in his shoes really do have standing and whether the courts, I think sort of questions about whether the court's precedents are really doing enough on that front. But both Christian Wagoner and Hashim Mupian for the government, I think, pointed out rightly that the court's cases like Susan Anthony List have pretty reasonably strict criteria for how you have to actually plead a chill. You can't just say, yeah, I thought about the speech. That's usually not good enough. And so if the court wants to tighten on that, they could add some potential language in their opinion. But I don't see that as a huge barrier to Shikei prevailing. And then the third sort of limit, I think, is something Justice Kavanaugh did drive home, which is there's a sense in these cases that nominal damages are sort of a stalking horse for attorney's fees. And what you don't want to have happen as a policy matter, perhaps, is you let these plaintiffs proceed with simply nominal damages claims for $1. And then municipalities or states are hit with, you know, state officials or individuals are hit with claims for, you know, like six-figure attorney's fees. And so Justice Kavanaugh's questions were sort of probing how often does it happen in practice and do the court's precedents with respect to prevailing parties entitled to attorney's fees and the way those have been interpreted by courts of appeals perhaps suggest that if you have only nominal damages awarded, you should not get sort of a bonanza of attorney's fees and sort of testing whether that's true in practice.
Great. And Justin, anything else to add on kind of some of the other gray areas or ways that the court might sort of take a step back from a nice, yeah, clear nominal damages always work?
All I would say is I think that's mostly right. I think the court is going to do a lot of the things Sarah mentioned by reaffirming previous limitations on standing and attorney's fees that they have in other cases. I think they're going to focus, but not to the exclusive on that as the sort of limiting principle on these compensatory damages claims. But we heard one thing in oral argument that I think might make it into the opinion, which is, you know, what if the defendant just, you know, tenders the nominal damages, do they have to do any more? And I think you might see something where the court might say, if they tender the nominal damages, that might be all the vindication the plaintiff is entitled to. The plaintiff may not have any entitlement to like a specific concession or statement or declaration from the court. You know, they get their compensatory damages. They can frame it and claim victory because of it, but they might not get a statement or anything more that they might want, or, you know, as Sarah mentioned, attorney's fees.
I realize this is really voluntary cessation doctrine, but to what degree do you think it will be relevant to the court, or could be relevant to the court, that, well, let me say it this way. One could imagine this case proceeding where, you know, the situation happened with Chike. The lawsuit was filed, and the university's general counsel immediately called counsel and said, you know, this is the first I'm hearing of this. We're going to fix it. They changed their policy the following week, and, you know, it sort of wrapped up, right? That's not what happened here. You had the school actually file a motion to dismiss on, you know, arguing that that constitutional rights weren't violated, and that followed you know, previous letters that had been sent to the school saying these policies are unconstitutional and here's why. But I wonder how much that might also factor into the nominal damages question, that, you know, there are nominal damages cases where, you know, the university or the defendant has been put on notice, and then there are the ones where it immediately recognizes the flaw in its policy and works to correct it. Do you think that'll matter? And that's for either one of you.
Yeah, this is Sarah. I think that's an interesting question, because going into this argument, one of the themes in George's briefing really was, look, if you are worried about the practice of governments perhaps strategically mooting cases, then the voluntary cessation doctrine, i.e. the doctrine where courts look to whether the government's actions seem to be in good faith and whether there's a possibility that they will, in fact, reinstate their policy down the road. You know, how much do they really repent and recant their policy? That's sort of the fix. And the interesting thing about argument today was that we didn't hear a lot of that. And I think one reason is because I think the justices were sort of less interested in thinking in a policy sense, like how do we sort of deal with this issue of, you know, government acting in good faith or not, and much more focused on the question presented, which is everyone agrees there's a past harm. What do you do about it? Are nominal damages really a form of damages that suffice to let the lawsuit proceed?
Justin, any additional thoughts there?
Yeah, I think this is mostly going to the court's pre-existing sort of attorney's fees analysis. I think the case, Supreme Court case, is Hensley. I know because I litigated that the Fifth Circuit version is Dearmore, but I think the Supreme Court case is Hensley, where the Supreme Court basically says that you need to get some relief from the court before the government's change in policy moots a case, would still entitle you to attorney's fees. And I expect anything the court says that to go back to that. But I otherwise agree with Sarah.
Well, and I think the Buchanan decision as well, right? I mean, those are like we said at the outset. There's frankly a whole litany of non First Amendment specific standing and kind of civ pro law that kind of underlies this case. So let's talk about Georgia's position. What were the biggest concerns that you heard with Georgia's position? Sarah, I'll let you sort of describe Georgia's position, and then what do you think the biggest concerns that you heard from argument today were?
Sure. So one of the things Georgia, I think, focused on at argument really is their take on the history and sort of saying this from – they're trying to, I think, appeal to a common sense, perhaps, instinct when you hear the word nominal damages, which is they're nominal. They don't mean anything. They're basically $0. And they're this sort of dinosaur of remedies because at common law, before law and equity merged, when you were just proceeding at law for violations of your personal rights, you might have a trespass, for instance, someone tramples your lawn. And that's a very hard harm to quantify, but Georgia's take on that is you suffered something, and they're saying under the history, you would get nominal damages not only because you suffered a technical trespass, but because the point of these kinds of violations and nominal damages, the common law, they say, was to make sure that you establish your rights to prevent recurrences of those violations going forward. And so they say, now we have declaratory judgments. That takes care of the situation for prospective relief. That's the judgment piece. And then they also say, look, I mean, nominal damages at common law, you couldn't just get them if all that happened to you was a violation that might not recur going forward. At best, maybe there are some situations where you claimed compensatory damages throughout the case and you just couldn't prove them, so you got nominal damages as a consolation prize. So that's kind of Georgia's theme throughout the argument. I think it got a little bit of traction with the chief, as I mentioned. But the main challenges to Georgia, I think, came from two fronts. One is Georgia got a fair amount of heat with respect to their take on the history and whether they're really sort of portraying the common law cases correctly. Justice Alito gave Kristen Wagoner for Chiki a couple of opportunities to hit back on common law examples that might undercut Georgia's position. And then second of all, Justices Kagan and Barrett in particular, with a little bit from Justice Alito too, really pressed Georgia on the idea of, look, you're claiming that nominal damages aren't compensatory in any way, but is that really right? I mean, what if, you know, Justice Kagan gave an example of Taylor Swift asking for $1 after claiming that I believe a radio host sexually assaulted her. She only wanted $1. And so the question is sort of, you know, is Taylor Swift entitled to $1? And if that's just a poor measure of the harm she obviously suffered, why is that not okay for constitutional violations too? So lots of variations on that theme. And at the end of the argument, sort of questions about if it's just, if a dollar is compensating you for something and isn't simply full compensation, why isn't that good enough? Why isn't that a fine form of damages?
Justin, I'll see if you have anything additional to add there, but also wanted to see if you had any, I believe you wanted to touch on some of the common law history issue that was being raised by the court.
Yeah, there was a question that Justice Kagan actually asked the government, Hashimupan, in support of Chike. But I think it really did a good job of highlighting the problem Georgia had, which is, as part of her question, Justice Kagan broke down sort of nominal damages claims into sort of three historical categories that sort of exist in the common law. One is sort of in place of a declaratory claims when you didn't necessarily have a declaratory judgment act or a formal way to get declaratory relief. A second was for claims where you did have damages, but the damages weren't easily calculable. We think of that it's particularly true in religious freedom cases, where how do you calculate the inability to pray in the way you want? It's not like you've suffered emotional distress in the way the law typically thinks of it. You've just suffered the inability to, have your religious and constitutional rights. And then the third way Justice Kagan described, these historically were sort of vindicative, the classic frame the dollar bill on the framework. And Georgia got peppered with questions hitting these categories the entire way. And, I agree that Mr. Pinson is a fantastic advocate and did the best he could with a weak hand. But, general rule of oral advocacy is, or any advocacy is, you want the solution for you to be simple and straightforward, and the solution for the other side to be complicated and difficult. It makes it a lot easier to rule for you. And you constantly heard Pinson having to say, well, this is a very complicated question. This is, we deal with this at a number of levels. Or I can distinguish that in these very narrow ways. And that, I think, was another hint I had that his case was unlikely to succeed.
So we've talked some about the chief seemed to be the most skeptical. Obviously, the Chief Justice has a long history with standing law and has maybe if anything, that has been, you know, one of the issues that sort of most defined his career, much less his time on the bench. But, you know, Sarah, how do you see, or what do you think of his questioning? You know, and I knew you had thought that it's possible that he ends up siding with Georgia here. What do you think of his line of questioning?
So let me just summarize it first in case folks weren't able to tune into all of the argument. The Chief's questions sort of hit on some familiar themes. So his first question for Kristen on behalf of Chike was, you know, if you're just throwing in $1 in a situation where you're saying there's no compensable injury and no risk of future violations happening, like he says, quote, doesn't that make a mockery of Article 3? Now, justices often play devil's advocates, but he kind of doubles down on this throughout the questioning and sort of says, look, you don't just get to vindicate your rights in court. That is not the kind of injury that Article 3 is meant to protect. You need something concrete. What is the concrete injury that nominal damages are, like, what are nominal damages doing besides symbolism? So that's kind of his first line of questioning for her. And then he picks up on a similar theme in questioning Hashim Ruhan for the government. He says, doesn't your position confuse standing and merits? We have to decide if there is a constitutional injury in the first place for there to be standing, right? And then he kind of picks up on the idea when questioning Andrew Pinson for Georgia and saying, you know, just to be clear, you're not saying nominal damages never suffice, but in trying to sort of figure out, you know, can he elicit the limits of Andrew's position in a somewhat sympathetic way? And giving Andrew a chance to respond to some of the common law history. So taking those three things together, I think some questions about are nominal damages just these sort of technical things that are supposed to let people stand up in court and vindicate somewhat abstract constitutional injuries, I think, from the Chief's framing of it, that may not even be injuries at all, depending on how they fare on the merits. And I think there is, you know, Casey, you mentioned a long history here, and I was just sort of forcefully reminded of the Chief's dissent in a case called Campbell-Ewald from the October 2015 term, which is about whether an offer of judgment, you know, if you offer someone money to settle the case, does that end the case? And the Chief's dissent is all about the idea that if you're just kind of pursuing a case in order to claim victory or in order to vindicate a legal principle, that is not enough to keep it going. And so he would have said sort of the mere offer of judgment, whether or not it's accepted, should move the case. And I think there's a real flavor of that here, which is it's just a dollar. Like, what does that really mean? Why do you get to keep going for a symbolic dollar? That doesn't make a lot of sense. So he may be playing devil's advocate, but he would not be surprised to see a dissent here.
Well, we're getting toward the end of our time, and I want to make sure we have sort of a grab bag opportunity here for people to flag things that were kind of particularly interesting to them. I will note one thing that I thought was interesting was the Justice Gorsuch question about a 25-cent bus fare and, you know, sort of probing about why a 25-cent bus fare would be sufficient to keep a case going, but a $1 nominal damages claim for violation of constitutional rights would not be. And I didn't hear, you know, it seemed to me to highlight that Georgia's argument risked being form over substance. And, you know, that was a challenging question, I thought, for Georgia. But frankly, all of that pales considering the fact that we actually got a Taylor Swift question. So who wants to, I know you've already touched on this, era, but so I don't know if you want to pick that up, but you want to describe any more, I guess, the Taylor Swift question that actually got picked up by two justices.
Sure. So I don't know if this is Taylor Swift's first time being mentioned in the Supreme Court argument or if she is a repeat player here. But Justice Kagan is clearly up on her pop culture knowledge. And was, you know, pursuing this line with Justice Barrett throughout the argument, which is, look, are nominal damages really compensatory or not? What about situations in which someone has clearly suffered a harm? For instance, Taylor Swift saying that she was sexually assaulted. She's very wealthy. She doesn't want more than a dollar. She doesn't need more than a dollar. She's just pursuing a dollar because she wants to pursue the case and have recognition that she, in fact, suffered a harm, even if a dollar isn't going to fully compensate her injury. And so the question for Georgia is, well, you know, if that is that dollar enough to keep the case alive? And Georgia ends up in a situation where they seem to say, no, not really. And then I think they do have some sort of, you know, there are problems in the end of the argument with respect to Justice Gorsuch then picking up on, well, look, how can it be the case that Shikay, for instance, suffered a violation of his First Amendment rights and then also perhaps had financial injury in the form of, you know, gas money. He drove to campus, so a dollar worth of gas. If you're saying that he has a receipt for the gas money or the bus fare that he took to get to campus and that that is compensation for, you know, like it actually measures the amount he took, how can you get the dollar for that, but not for the constitutional violation? If there's a situation where you don't have to get 100% of your injury compensated, but you have to get something. And then Justice Barrett really picks up on this with a series of hypotheticals about statutes that give sort of statutory damages for things like annoying text messages that you didn't receive. And she sort of culminates with a great question and sort of saying, look, you're telling me, Georgia, that you can get maybe even $1 in statutory damages for annoying text messages, but you can't get a dollar because the government violated your First Amendment rights. And so this really, I think, turned into the theme of questioning for Georgia and, you know, full of, I think, very accessible hypotheticals for people to seize on.
Justin, anything else to add, I guess, before you open up for questions?
No, I think that covers it.
Good deal. Well, Micah, I think we are ready for whatever you got.
All right. Terrific. We'll now move to our first caller.
Hi, this is Bob Fitzpatrick in D.C. Someone said this was a stalking horse for attorney's fees, and I couldn't agree more. I'm an employment lawyer, and I represent typically plaintiffs. So I have some sympathy regarding the issue of attorney's fees. Someone said they saw 8-1 or 9-0, and there was a lot of talk or some talk about Justice Kavanaugh's comments about attorney's fees. I don't see a basis to reduce fees here. I don't see 6, much less 9, agreeing there's a basis to reduce fees. It sounds like from what I'm hearing that all of the attorney time seems to have been, the plaintiff attorney time seems to have been allocated to responding to Georgia's defense until it finally went belly up and said, okay, we'll change. And I can't see Kagan, Sotomayor, and Breyer going along with a reduction in fees. So I wonder if it is not more likely that at the end of the opinion, if they say anything about fees, they just say it's back to the district court judge to decide whether fees should be awarded, and if so, how much.
Thanks, Bob. And obviously that's, you know, the normal way that these cases are resolved. The attorney's fees question, at least, is resolved, is that there's a pretty wide amount of discretion for the district court on the amount of fees. You know, I think there is, to me, there is a, you know, that's where it could be significant that Georgia initially took the position that the Constitution had not been violated here at all, and then ultimately ended up changing that position. That's where it could be significant, but curious as to for other people's thoughts on the call.
It's certainly the case that the Supreme Court does not usually decide attorney's fees with respect to the particular case. I think what's much more likely is that the court will send messages about how to interpret its precedents, like Buchanan, on how to figure out what attorney's fees are appropriate in a case to give district courts more guidance on remand in cases, in this case and in other ones. And so I could see in response to some of Justice Kavanaugh's questions, the court might emphasize that, yes, district courts retain discretion to figure out what sort of attorney's fees should be awarded to the prevailing party and that nominal damages do make one side the prevailing party, but that courts should keep in mind that nominal damages may be a factor that significantly weighs against a large award of attorney's fees or something. That kind of language to give district courts guidance in what the court's precedents in this area mean.
The other thing I would say is they may, if they accept this tender argument discussion that happened, oral argument, where the government could tender the nominal damages and moot the case, unless they go ahead and change, you know, McKinnon, like if that happens before there's even a preliminary judgment in the case, and you can't have a preliminary monetary judgment, so if there was never any declaratory relief or preliminary injunction you're talking about before the damages are awarded, then the, you know, even having fought this hard, you know, the plaintiff in this case wouldn't be the prevailing party and wouldn't be attorney, wouldn't be eligible for any fees regardless of how hard they fought and how hard the government fought until this point. It's one of the reasons that McKinnon's such a controversial decision that's often criticized by a lot of civil rights organizations.
Thank you all.
All right. We'll now move to our next caller in the queue.
Hi, great discussion today. A question regarding the 11th Amendment and what role, if any, that's played in the arguments on this. My recollection is that nominal damages are a bit of an anomaly considered equitable relief in order to get around the 11th Amendment. So I'm just curious whether the justices seem to have any interest in tinkering with the 11th Amendment, perhaps broadening it, perhaps reconsidering how they classify nominal damages, anything along those lines.
Thank you. I know that there was an opinion maybe 15 years or so or more ago that was not unanimous, where the court was kind of looking at Hans versus Louisiana, which had interpreted the 11th Amendment, which, to put my cards on the table, I'm a radical and think Hans versus Louisiana should be overturned, and that the citizens of the same state should be able to sue that state in federal court. But I'll open it up to the folks here. Do you think kind of what openness do you think there is on the 11th Amendment, or kind of reconsidering those questions that really kind of underlie why this becomes an issue, I guess?
Sure. I mean, this is Sarah. I don't see that being an issue in this particular case. I think the court has plenty to work with in terms of the questions before the court, in terms of how to even conceive of nominal damages and how they relate to mootness doctrine. Is the court going to be thinking about things like, really, I think, more of a question of qualified immunity in a lot of these cases, with respect to, is it good for suits against individual officials for nominal damages to be able to proceed, and, you know, establishing the law in a clear fashion so that, you know, governments can't keep claiming that they got rid of the policy, so there is no clearly established law. Is that in the back of their minds? Maybe, but it didn't really come up with a lot of arguments. So it doesn't. So I take it from that it probably isn't weighing on the justices too much for this case.
I think that's right.
I agree with Sarah. That it's not likely to come up in this issue. I heard nothing come up with this issue. I think that my personal view is I'm skeptical that this court will do anything with sovereign immunity or qualified immunity, even though I agree they should on both counts. I'm much more in line with what I assume Casey's views are on both those issues. I do also want to just point out, as, you know, as a civil rights attorney working for a nonprofit, that even if, you know, with a nominal damages claim, even if this, you know, the Uzug Benham wins and civil rights patients continue to bring nominal damages cases, they still have to deal with both sovereign immunity and qualified immunity in these cases, depending on the situation, depending on who you're suing, depending on how the case unfolds. And those are still pretty difficult barriers if you're trying to use that to vindicate constitutional rights on a going forward basis, which civil rights nonprofits often have to do in precisely the situations we talk about in our brief.
I think the other thing I would just flag for everyone too, that one of the other complicating factors of campus speech litigation specifically is that, you know, for a student like Chike, you can only be subject to a policy like this for, you know, for up to 4 years, right? For at least for the typical student. So there's kind of this confined period where the policy actually applies to you, and then you know, you leave. There's an incentive for universities, or at least a disincentive for universities to want to hurry up and address your constitutional question. You know, because unlike a normal citizen who, you know, might object to a city policy on speaking on the sidewalk, for example, and may live there for the next 50 years. If you are a junior in college and you complain about a university policy, there is a date certain when the school can be pretty confident that you're no longer going to be a problem, and you're going to leave. Not saying that universities, you know, completely operate on that basis, but that, I think that's a reality, at least in some cases, that if you are challenging a policy, you're going to be leaving at some point. So,
and I'll just add that this is even more, that it is true, but it's even more true in an area we deal with a lot of, which is jails. Jails, unlike prisons, their people are usually there only if they're either awaiting trial for a case without bail, or if they're charged, if they're convicted of a misdemeanor, which usually, you know, almost always carries a year less of time. And so those people are coming out even earlier. And so for their claims to be vindicated is even, you know, requires a much faster pace. And the government can almost always wait out the clock in those cases. It's very difficult to bring jail cases.
Well, I'm just greatly appreciate Justin and Sarah, you taking the time to watch or listen to the argument this morning and prepare and offer your thoughts here. And thank you to the Federalist Society for providing this opportunity. And thank you to Micah for helping us make this happen.
And on behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd like to thank all of our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.